Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes. Nice
dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
You're listening to Unfiltered with James O'Brien, brought to you by Joe.
Hello and welcome to the very latest Unfiltered, which features this week David Baddiel, a man who, well, I guess when I was about 14 or 15 years old and possibly for quite a few years after that, I thought was the absolute don. He's hitting the road next month from the 28th of January with a show called My Family Not the Sitcom, which I haven't seen, but he knows this and I'm glad I haven't seen it because I'll be able to ask questions about why he's written it and what he's done with it. And hopefully that will sort of provide a certain symmetry to the interview. Welcome to Unfiltered, David Baddiel.
Hi, James.
It's a pleasure to have you here. Normally, and not that there is much of a format, but normally we sort of do the story so far and then move on to whatever masterpiece you are currently involved in. But given that your latest masterpiece is quite spectacularly autobiographical, I'm not quite sure. I'm not quite sure how this is going to.
It's up to you.
Pan out. It's
your show.
Up to you.
It's up to me. Yeah, it's a dynamic, isn't it?
It is. So let's wait and see. Let's start in Dollis Hill.
Okay.
Where the Baddiel clan had settled, but your mother. I mean, both sides of your family had quite traumatic backstories.
No, my dad not so much.
But your mum very much.
My dad, way back. I mean, any immigrant, any Jew. I've tried to avoid the word Jew.
It lasted all of 2 minutes.
I know, because like, I get occasional stick from people. I'm going to say anti-Semites, but some of them are just people, for over-mentioning it. But I suppose if you are talking about my background, it's quite hard.
Yes, this is
not
true.
Not to, and since you brought up trauma, it's incredibly hard. Yeah, they both had trauma, but my mum had direct trauma, whereas my dad's was a few generations back.
Right.
With my mum, she was born in Nazi Germany. And sort of not smuggled out, although I think she was, like, you know, put on top of a train thing, like where the luggage is. But I think it was all. What I do know is that it took a lot of stuff because basically my grandparents were very wealthy in Germany. They ran a brick factory. I found most of this out when I did Who Do You Think You Are?
Yes.
I knew a bit of it, but found out more when I did that. They lost it all. It all got nicked, obviously, by the Nazis. And then at the very last minute, basically my granddad was trying to put £1,000, which is what you need. It's interesting considering what we have now with immigrants and whatever. The British government at that time were asking anyone who wasn't in kinder transported, so either not a child or whatever, they had to show £1,000, a lot of money, obviously, in the 30s, in a British bank account before they would let you in.
Wow.
And my granddad didn't have any money, but he did have some other people who'd got out already. So he'd contacted a lot of them and said, can you just lend me that money, put it in the bank account, and eventually I might get enough money for the British government to let me in. 3 weeks to go before the war broke out. I mean, he didn't know that at the time.
Sure.
But as it was like a race against time,
yes.
As it turned out. They did it, and he got the papers and blah, blah, blah. I mean, all sorts of other stuff went on, but sure. Basically. And they got out and arrived in this country with 3 weeks to go before the war broke out. So that was my mum, and my mum...
How old was your mum then when this happened?
She was like, well, actually, that's slightly confused.
And
because my mum has got two birth certificates,
right.
One of which I think was redone because they were having trouble getting her out. And my mum, this is a very long story, but basically one of the things I investigated on Who Do You Think You Are was that my mum was of the belief that her real parents were not her parents, that her real parents were actually her uncle, who was younger, who just got married. Right. Her mum was quite old by those standards when she had her sort of 40. She thought her parents couldn't have children. And that what really happened was that her uncle, who died in the Warsaw Ghetto, I think, there's no actual record of him, my great uncle, Arno, that he was her real dad. And he had said, look, I've had a baby, but I'm not getting out. You are. Take the baby. Now, here's the key thing about that, is it's quite a good story. And that may be why my mum thought it.
Oh, really?
My mum, as my show demonstrates, yes, was someone who liked a good story. And she liked a little bit of, you know, look at me, I'm a bit important, I'm a bit glamorous. And she was not beyond definitely using the Holocaust to get that as part of herself. Definitely. And I said this on Who Do You Think You Are, but they cut it out.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yes, well, it is. It's a little arresting, isn't it?
Because literally she said it, the cameras came to their house. Mm. They lived in Cambridge at the time, my parents. And my mum suddenly said all this. And I said, I've never heard this before. I'd never heard it before, but I don't know, maybe it's true. And then I was off in Poland trying to find out if it's true. But all the time I was saying, my mum might just have made this up.
Wow.
You know? I've no idea. They cut all that out.
That's odd, though. That you wouldn't know. You didn't know much about your granddad's business. You didn't know. I mean, so it wasn't a story that you were regaled with often then during childhood.
My grandparents didn't talk about it much. My grandparents had a really fucking hard time. Yeah.
Can I say your granddad was interned. Yes, yeah. Of course he could.
Well, he was interned, but actually interned. No, he liked being interned.
The Isle of Man was a relief.
Yeah. No. He had a hard time in Germany. Right. Basically, his whole family had been murdered, primarily. That's the main thing. But also, as far as I can make out, from pictures that I've seen, and also when I did Who Do You Think You Are, I went to the site of my granddad's brick factory,
right,
which is now in a place called Kaliningrad, where actually England are playing Tunisia,
dovetailing beautifully.
Somewhere like that. But it's really the arse end of the old Soviet Union now.
Right.
It was a very beautiful German East Prussian town called Königsberg, to where Immanuel Kant was from. And famously, someone who invented topography called Euler, he used to travel the seven bridges of Königsberg, and my book, The Secret Purposes, which is my third novel, is about that. It's about, begins with Königsberg, but then it got just bombed like by the Russians and by the Americans, and next thing you know, it's really like a devastated place.
Yeah.
And I went and found my grandfather's brick factory, and it's enormous, but it's stumps now.
Right, yes. You get an idea of scale.
Yeah, I got an idea of scale of it. And so they were like sort of, not aristocratic, because no Jews are aristocratic, but they were very successful haute bourgeois people. They lost it all. But my grandparents didn't really want to talk about it very much.
No, I suppose not.
Because it was like very traumatic. Yes. My grandfather was in a mental hospital with depression throughout the post-war period. You know, with depression, right? I've had depression.
Mm.
And it's very bad, what I'm going to say, in terms of modern political correctness. Because I am very much of the belief that you can be depressed for all sorts of reasons. And there's no reason why you should blah, 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 you know. But my granddad had fucking good cause,
yes,
to be depressed.
Yes.
You know, straightforwardly, he had good reason to be depressed. So
there's probably two different types, though, isn't there? I mean, because there's the one that is reactive, and then there's the one that's chemical.
Well,
and then sometimes they'll combine.
Yeah, sometimes they'll combine. I think that's correct. I mean, having been there myself, when I was depressed, one of the things I used to feel bad about, and you can feel bad,
yes,
and be depressed at the same time,
yes,
was I thought, shouldn't be depressed. I know people with cancer, and they're not depressed. What the fuck's wrong with me?
Being rational.
Yeah, but meanwhile, he did have proper cause to be depressed.
Sure.
And, he really did. And that had a big effect on my mum. Well, actually, one of the things about the show is about both my parents, but it's more about my mum. I think people who haven't seen it think it's more about my dad, because the dementia thing is a big old hot take and people get into it. But although it is about that, really the show is about memory, and it's about how you remember people. And I noticed at my mum's funeral, which was 3 years ago now, that all these people were telling me how wonderful my mum was. And what I thought bound all these people together was they didn't really know her, right? And they were just saying what you say at funerals.
Yes.
And I wanted to say, well, she was sort of wonderful, but mainly she was mental. I mean, really mental. And the biggest thing in my mum's life, certainly from the time being that I was like old enough to have a proper engagement with my mother, was that she'd had an affair with a golfing memorabilia salesman.
But this sounds
and
like,
turned her life over to golf in a very erotic way.
And that is the point at which everybody who's spoken to you about this show suggests that sounds like something you could have written.
Yeah. I didn't.
But it, I mean, it is almost implausible. The golfing memorabilia. The affair isn't, but the golfing memorabilia salesman adds a sort of platform of comedy.
But that's the key element to it, yes. Really, which is that when I was depressed, I was in therapy for quite a long time.
When was this, David?
When I was depressed in my 30s. Right. I had proper... I would say I had clinical depression in my 30s. And I, to be honest, I'd had something like faux depression quite a lot before that. That sort of thing that you might have in your... Well, not everyone, but I would say I had... in my sort of late teens, early 20s, which was like a pose of depression.
Yes.
And then when it entered my life properly, I thought, that's nonsense.
Big difference.
There's a really, really big difference. She was always talking, the therapist, about, you know, well, the damage that's done by my mum and this affair.
Was it Freudian?
No, it wasn't actually. No. It was something called relational therapy, okay. In which the therapist puts their feelings into the room.
All right.
Yeah, but never mind that for the minute, because that's going to lead us into a whole other area.
I was trying to sound clever.
A couple of times she did put her feelings into the room, and they involved telling me to fuck off. But that's not the point. The point is that she would often say, you know, you obviously had this very complicated upbringing.
Yes.
And from a Freudian point of view, it is very complicated, because my mum was very brazen about her affair, very keen to tell people about her affair, very keen to tell me and my brothers about the affair, because my mum thought it was glamorous in a very 70s way. She thought having an affair was glamorous, right?
Yes.
And so when I'm in therapy talking about it and trying to be serious about it, what I always noticed was I wanted to laugh because it was so much about golf, right? I wanted to say it's quite hard to be the therapy and really crying and really upset. Oh, yeah, she was far too much. It was too much. It was damaging. No, it was about golf. And it would make me want to laugh. So when I came to write the show, the show embraced that.
Yes.
And it embraced it in a way that I think is positive, because it didn't, if you see the show, I don't think you have seen
it. I haven't seen it, no.
But it's one thing, it's very much not. It's not judgmental about my mother. It's a very celebratory show about both my parents in a very, I would say, unusual way, because I've taken what most people would think, I think, as the stuff you don't talk about,
yes,
after someone's died or got dementia, and said, no, this is who they were, and it's absolutely not good parenting, and it's absolutely probably damaging or whatever, but it's fucking hilarious and it's true, yeah. And that's what I'm going to hang on to, and that's, yes, what I'm going to say. It's true. It's made me who I am. I am kind of happy with who I am, sure, even through all this, yes, shit. So why not celebrate?
But look at what it involved, or look at the mangle of my life.
But comedy,
come out the other end.
I genuinely believe, in a way that I hope is not, you know, like a comedian trying to do an inspirational quote. But I genuinely believe that comedy is a way through.
Yes,
like my process with trolls on Twitter is never to ignore them, to try and make a joke about them.
Yes.
And I'm successful at that sometimes, sometimes less successful. But I think if you can make them funny,
yes,
then A, it's like someone just did that. Someone just, I don't know if you saw that, but I was at a conversation.
No, I did. The Holocaust, yeah, reference.
I was doing a chat at a place called JW3, which is this Jewish venue, with a woman called Devorah Baum, who's an academic, who's done a really good book called The Jewish Joke, which is an investigation of what Jewish jokes are. And she told this joke, which I thought was a very beautiful joke, which was a Holocaust survivor after the Holocaust goes up to heaven, tells God a Holocaust joke, and God says, that's not funny. And the Holocaust survivor says, well, I guess you had to be there.
Which is a brilliant
It's a beautiful
joke. On many levels.
On many, many, yes, levels. And the level I chose to illustrate, chose to pull out of it for me was that it says, you know, he wasn't, was,
yeah,
he? Because Auschwitz was the place without God. You know, whether you believe in God or not,
sure,
it's the place without God.
Yes.
You know, and that, I think, is part of what makes it a beautiful joke. So there's been lots of responses to it, some from Christians, right? Some from people just being weird. Some bloke who told me God is not a he or a
you're
she.
Still quite, it's an you're, it. You're still quite... Your Twitter game is strong, but some of it still shocks you, right? Some of it, there's a sense of surprise.
Well,
I've been immersed in it for a little bit longer than you.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, you get it as well.
Yes.
I mean, sometimes I'm shocked. Sometimes I find, is it possible to be shocked anymore?
Yeah, of course. No.
I mean, I'm not really shocked by the anti-Semitism.
Right.
Because
but no, I was thinking more of the crassness. The poor quality of the anti-Semitism, if you pardon the expression.
Well, one bloke, because there was, let's take two examples. I got one just now, which was standard anti-Semitism, which was someone who responded to that tweet.
Yes.
Which has got loads of good responses, loads of interesting responses as well. You should never forget there are people who are really interesting and genuine and appreciate stuff.
Yes.
But one bloke, called something like white resistance, whatever, start saying, yeah, but did 6 million really die? Check your facts, holler hoax, right? But then brilliantly, some people have said, because I said, comedy workshops are not what they used to be, right? and then some people have started saying, yeah, holler hoax is not really a very good pun, is it? because they didn't spend very long on that, but I suppose hoax, of course, didn't really work. And then someone else has just tweeted to say it should really be folacorst, as in F-A-U-X.
Oh, so
right?
Strong.
And then he said the trouble with these people, these deniers, they spend much more time on denying than punning. And you see, for me...
That saves everything.
That's the correct way of dealing with it.
Of course.
The correct way of dealing with it is not to say, as some other people have said, I mean, you know, good luck to these people saying it, but this is terrible, so depressing, it's awful. It is all those things, but it exists.
Yes.
And it really fucking exists.
Point and laugh.
And I say point and laugh, yeah, because I think that's, as a comedian, that is the way of dealing with it. And in a different way, the show does that, which is the show says, some of this stuff probably was really damaging.
But were you doing that as a young man? Were you finding comedy in your own situation? Because, I mean, off the top of my head, you must have felt aggrieved on your father's behalf. Mm. I mean, that side of it.
Well, I possibly am still to some extent, although you see, that's partly why the other half of the show is about my dad, because my dad was in no way model dad. My dad was in no way was he a statue. What's that say? Okay, sorry, I thought the police had come to get me. My dad was, I think...
But were you cracking jokes about your own situation when you were young? You were.
Well, not when I was really young. I don't know when it first, this whole scenario
golfing
first appeared, probably when I was
chapter.
About 11.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so 11
again,
or 12.
Again, a tough age, mate.
Just... Yeah, but I think certainly me and my brothers, and my older brother particularly, we did think it was funny. I mean, we were a little bit confused initially, because it wasn't like, I'm having this affair and now golf. Right. It was like golf. Right. Now, you weren't interested in golf, Mother. Why are you interested in golf? Yeah. What's happening? And there's golf everywhere, because my mum started selling golfing memorabilia,
right,
which would have pissed him off, because he sold golfing memorabilia.
Right.
That's another thing I point out in the show, is that the last thing I think he wanted from this affair was a rival in golfing memorabilia. But that's what happened. So I think we were confused for a bit, and then it became clear, because she did used to talk about it a lot. And, you know, my brother tells the story, which is in the show, because the show includes film.
Yes.
So I filmed my brother telling this story about how he was with a new girlfriend called Tracy, and he took Tracy to meet my mum at her stall, Golfiana, in Gray's Antique Market in Bond Street, which, by the way, was opposite my dad's dinky toy stall. So you'd have thought he might have noticed. Anyway, she's talking to Ivor, and then she mentions this bloke, who's, I'm going to say his name, because I mention it in the show all the time. It's his real name, David White. His name just comes up. And then she turns to Tracy and goes, I've been his lover for 20 years. And then just carries on speaking to Ivor as if she's not said anything of any note, right? And she was always doing shit like that.
She was glamorising herself then,
totally.
In the same way as possibly she did with the story of her origin.
That's why I link those two things.
Yeah. My stereotype of a North London Jewish family, though, would be a degree of concern about what the neighbours thought.
Yeah, but my parents were not stereotypical Jewish parents in any way. Really not at all.
No.
I mean, that's, I think, one of the things about my previous show that I did. It was called Fame Not Musical. And that was really a show about how, if you've been in British showbiz for a long time, or in any kind of showbiz for a long time, at the sort of level I have, which is sort of like all right level, but not super famous, right? Then what you get is a sort of endless stream of sort of mundane shit that happens to you as a result of being slightly recognised, misrecognised, people like thinking you're this and you're not, essentially having a version of yourself out there that isn't you.
Yes.
And with me, one of those versions is, oh, he comes from a Jewish family, therefore they must be kind of quite wealthy intellectual bohemians from Hampstead, a bit like the Freuds or something. They were nothing like that.
But not just because of the Jewish North London angle, also because of, you know, going to Trinity to read English and stuff.
Kings,
I beg your pardon, to read English.
Yeah.
There's a presumption that you must have come from that milieu.
No, I didn't.
And I know you didn't, but it's not just that people see geography and religion. It would also be what brought you to their attention was quite rarefied comedy and that kind of...
Maybe.
I don't know.
I don't know. Maybe. I think it's also to do with like having glasses and stuff.
It could also
and not
be that.
Being, you know, a class warrior as alternative comedians were in the 80s, which I obviously was not. But what I always do think about you know, being from an immigrant stock... Mm. Is that you don't think of class in the same way anyway. I mean, I went to a private school, but I went there because it was direct grant at the time.
Yes.
And direct grant meant that my dad, who had literally no money because he'd been made redundant and hadn't worked for 3 years, was able to send me there because, you know, he was means tested and that
qualified.
Meant,
but you'd have to pass an academic test.
Yeah, no, but that's the key thing, is I was and still am quite clever.
Yes.
And being clever meant that I got into that school and then I got into Cambridge. And that kind of aspirational thing due to intellect is an immigrant thing.
Right.
And actually, when I go and read now, because I do children's books now, to the, if I go to any schools, really, but certainly those schools which are very, like, you know, a little bit academic and pushy or whatever, sure. It's mainly Indian kids now. It's yes. Asian kids. And I think, again, there's that thing with an immigrant community of, like, well, we want our kids to do well. Now, I think if... there's still in this country a slightly weird thing with that. Yeah. Not so much if you're from that background, but if you're from a background that is seen as white, which Jewish sort of is, although right. not by Hollerhawks, man, right? I think it's assumed, oh, well, if he's white and he's going to Cambridge, he must be posh.
Yes.
And that isn't correct in my case, and actually lots of other people's.
They're probably more correct 10 years after you left than it was for
possibly.
Your journey. It seems to have gone a bit backwards, that notion of mobility.
Well, certainly...
to
yeah.
Oxbridge.
Yeah, well, and those schools stopped as well.
Yes.
I thought that was good. I mean, you know.
So you knew you were clever?
I knew I was clever.
From?
Yeah.
11?
I guess,
eight,
yeah.
Nine,
I did well at school.
Yeah.
I was articulate.
Were there books in the house? Was it a literary?
Yeah, it wasn't. No, well, my mum, not at all.
No, until she got her collection of Nick Faldo memoirs.
Golf books. Yes, and yes. She wrote golf. My mum wrote 5 books about golf.
I mean, she really went all in on it.
Oh, God, yeah, I should have brought one. All things like Golf the Golden Years and, you know, Out on the Links. They're mainly anthologies with
right,
pictures
yes. okay.
of, like, ornamental people playing golf.
So, school, clever. I mean, scholarship effectively, although it called different things. I mean, a means-tested academic entrance.
Yeah.
Thinking of the future at all? Just because I'm always intrigued by that footlights journey and whether or not everybody turns up jumping onto the stage. I mean, performing, was that was that in your blood or was
no.
that... No.
No,
I thought you were going to say that.
The same thing, really, as... whatever the image I've painted of the sort of bookish.
Yeah.
I mean, my dad, he did have quite a lot of books, but they were mainly history and science. My dad was a scientist. Before he got made redundant, he worked for Unilever as a kind of middle manager,
right.
although I think he had aspirations to do more than that as a scientist, but they never really worked out.
Right.
So we had science books, we had history books. My mum did actually, was keen, and I think was important for me, on just reading... you know, Enid Blyton and stuff like that. But I didn't come from that background. And then performing, in fact, showbiz was even further away.
Yes.
I remember when I was for my bar mitzvah, I managed to get an electric guitar. Not a very good electric guitar, like a Columbus Stratocaster. Yeah. And it cost like 40 quid or something from a place in Hendon. But I remember telling a bloke at school that I had an electric guitar and he thought I was lying. And he thought I was lying because it was such a symbol of another world, like Top of the Pops, David Bowie, whatever, that the idea that someone he knew could have an electric guitar just seemed ridiculous. And that was my distance from showbiz.
Why did you want an electric guitar?
Oh, I wanted to be like...
Can you play?
Yeah, I can play that. And I was in a band, well, not then, but when I was 16, I was in a kind of new wave band with a bloke who then went on to be in a band called The Sundays. Have you heard The Sundays?
Of course.
Yeah, Dave Gavrick.
Reading, writing,
The Sundays.
And arithmetic.
That's right. He's
Harry.
My oldest friend.
Is that right?
He's my oldest mate, yes.
That.
And I was in a band with him, and he was like 100
times
better.
But then
than
you're
me.
Contradicting yourself in a way, because...
I'm not. Being in a band isn't...
It is.
You know what, about performing, you
mean? Showbiz, being a million miles away from you. Well, you got a guitar at 14 and you're in a band at 16 with somebody who went on to conquer the hit parade. That must have been an impulse. You didn't get pulled onto the stage.
No, sorry, Joe, I agree with that. What I mean is when I read, I don't know, I can't think of anyone at the moment,
sure.
but when I read people for whom showbiz was properly in their blood,
yes.
it tends to, you know, like the Redgraves or whatever.
Okay.
I mean, that's unfair because that's obviously a dynasty. But there were people... I'm sure there are people who we think of as stars who, even if they didn't come from that background,
right.
were performing from a very early age and were fostered to do so, I mean, you know, encouraged to do so by their parents, and there's probably footage of them. I didn't have anything like that. And my parents didn't...
About school plays and stuff like that? Were you...
No, although I do remember in my Jewish primary school, I had one line in my school play, which is the most Jewish line ever. This was it. It was, "Well, Rabbi, you certainly do drive a hard bargain."
Oh,
that
Lord.
Was it. And you think when you hear that, the Jewish line is Rabbi, but unfortunately it's bargain. But that was my one line in the school play. I didn't have any school play action in my secondary school at all.
Do you remember getting a buzz when you were in the band? Do you remember, was there no sense of the crowd?
I was very interested in music.
Right.
And still am.
Yes.
And I did play classical piano, because I think that is another thing about being from an immigrant family, is that the one thing that did show aspiration, apart from wanting us to be educated, was that my parents were sort of obsessed with classical music, certainly my mum. And that may have been the German thing, because her dad was like a big Wagner fan, even though he was like, you know, had good reason not to like Wagner. And so I learned classical piano, and then I taught myself the guitar. And as my big rock and roll punk rock statement when I was 16, I went along to my grade 7 and I deliberately played the wrong note. I was going to say all the wrong notes. It was one wrong note throughout a piece. That was my big Ted Grundy Sex Pistols moment. And I failed grade 7. But before that, I'd gone to quite a lot of classical concerts without really understanding it or liking it.
Duty.
It's more than duty. It was a thing that you have as a kid. I don't know if you had anything like this, where you're trying to find out who you are. Yeah. And in my case, my parents slightly decided to, certainly my mum, fill that in for me. So she wanted me to be someone who liked classical music. She also wanted me to be someone who liked books. And she was right about that, but she wasn't right about classical music. And I still have problems with classical music, which I would like to like.
Yes.
But as soon as I hear it now, I feel like that 11-year-old who was dragged along by my grandfather to see Daniel Barenboim at the Royal Festival Hall or whatever.
Yeah.
But anyway, I like music and I wanted to be in a band, but I don't feel that as showbiz. I think if you were...
That's because you were musical. You didn't want to be in a band to get laid. You wanted to be in a band
I wasn't even a band. I wasn't a singer.
No.
I wanted to be in a band because I like music. And it was 1979. And I think if you were 16 and had an electric guitar and some mates, you were in a band.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, but I didn't have any big performing thing. I wasn't people who say, oh, I went to Anna Scher, I did all that. I didn't do any of that.
So when did you discover? Because I presume...
No, there was a thing, which was kind of weird. Because there was the key moment for me was my brother playing me Derek and Clive. That's the key moment. That's when I thought, I want to do this.
Yes.
I want to be...
But Derek and Clive is weird, though, because that's very into it. It's tapes that you can... Most people listen to on small, old-fashioned tape recorders. It's not stadium stuff. It's not audience stuff. It's a very intimate comedy.
But remember, again, we're talking, 70s. When did I hear that? Probably when I was 14.
But I don't think of Derek and Clive as necessarily being performance art. It's closer to...
I think it's really... It's very high comedy, in my opinion.
Yes, but it's closer to eavesdropping.
Maybe, but I think... Don't forget what I'm saying is... In Britain, certainly, and this is before the internet, so there wasn't much seeing of American comedians can happen.
Yeah.
You're looking at Jasper Carrot, Billy Connolly, and then a bunch of fat men in bow ties who aren't funny.
Yeah.
I really liked Jasper Carrot and Billy Connolly then, but it still didn't probably speak to me in the same way as Derek and Clive did.
Who are absolutely filthy, but also incredibly sophisticated characters for people who don't know, created by Peter Cook and Dudley Moore. And your brother presumably brought this to you with a real sense of excitement and said, David, you've got to check this.
He had a cassette of it, of Derek and Clive Live,
yeah.
And it felt very secret, even though my dad was the swearest man in the world and would probably have loved it and probably did hear it, I don't know, but it still felt like we were listening to this in my brother's bedroom secretly. And what I still think about Derek and Clive is, and what I still love about it, is there's a liberation in it of like, we are just going to say the first thing that comes into our heads. Yeah. We are two incredibly funny men, so it's going to be funny, but it's going to be no censorship, no inhibition, whatever.
And then they start egging each other
on. And they're drunk for a lot of it and all the rest of it. And some of it isn't funny, and some of it probably is unacceptable now, all the rest of it. But at the time, I think this is like poetry. It's like comic poetry. People have said punk. Maybe. But either way, there's something that I really love about it, which I think is important to me artistically, which is it's got a deep comic authenticity to it. It's people who aren't thinking, oh, how should I be funny? And what's the prevailing thing that I should be doing to try and catch, whatever thing it is that I should appear as comic? No, I'm going to go to the sort of id of comedy that's in me, and I'm just going to bounce out what's in there. And that felt so funny and unbelievably funny. And then what happened was about a year after that, so I was interested in comedy, my school review happened. And my school had a sketch show, a review, which happened at lunchtime. And every year it was rubbish. I mean, without fail, terrible. It was like songs and... I mean, my school wasn't a posh public school. It was a bourgeois public school, private school. So it was mainly kids from North London, quite a lot of Jews. They're not posh, but some of them are quite rich. But for some reason, it had... like a maybe like all petty bourgeois schools do, and they try to aspirate and try to be like a public school.
Sure.
So, for example, I arrived there, they don't play soccer. I was always really fucked off about that.
Yeah, same at my school, which was a proper public school, but it was a snobby thing to play rugger.
Rugger, anyway, because Eton and Harrow play soccer.
I know.
So I was always really pissed off about that.
Me
I think
too.
Part of that was this show, they had songs about, you know, I don't know, what a lovely place the school was, as if it was like a place that you punt at.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So there's all that happening and it's rubbish and every year no one's interested and people just talk throughout it. Then for some reason that I still don't know, I got asked to write it with this other bloke called Nick. And I decided what we're going to do, which is what surely kids want, is sketches about the teachers.
Yeah.
And they were very, very strong sketches about the teachers that we wrote.
This is your final year?
That time you had to stay on an extra term to do Oxbridge.
Yes.
So I was about to do that.
Sixth term.
Yeah, I was in my extra term. And that was the people who always put it on. It's called the 6S Review.
Yes. Okay.
Right. So I do. So I write these sketches, which include, for example, the librarian, who I remember was a very strict and unpleasant man, but also a Christian. We had him having sex with the library assistant, who was a woman, but she was a blow-up doll in our thing, on the photocopier with the sketch involved boys, you know, making photocopies of it while it was going on.
Gosh.
You know, we had another sketch whereby I was the music teacher and I came on, and he always used to do this in assemblies to try and get people to sing the hymns, but I just swore at the audience, telling them to fucking sing, right? And it was like that, and I still think, let's be self-aggrandizing for a minute, I've stormed some gigs, but it may be still amongst the best response I've ever got.
Because one could believe what they were saying.
No one could believe it. I mean, the kids went mental for it. It really went through the roof, and it was supposed to be on all week, like every lunchtime. It was immediately taken off by the school. I was immediately taken to the headmaster's office, and they said, right, we should expel you, but because we want you to go to Cambridge, and they didn't say this, but what they meant was, we are aware of our league tables. We're not going to expel you, but you're really bad and blah, blah, blah. And that was great because it meant I didn't get expelled, but I was suddenly cool at school.
Had you not been cool before?
Especially. I was the much cooler people than me.
Were you popular?
I was all right. I wasn't really hated at school.
Sure.
I'm actually, just to tell you, and I don't think I'm going to forget this, so I was going to start another story, but there's a heckle, famous heckle, which has been put down to me. People think it's me. It was heckled at, but in fact, it's not me. It's me who told the story.
Right.
And the story was there was an open spot at the Comedy Store called Cynical Sid. And Cynical Sid goes on stage and he's doing really badly. And he's kind of like, it's obvious, Cynical Sid shouldn't even be on stage. Mm. He's kind of like very awkward and whatever. And then eventually, someone at the back shouts, "Everybody hates you. Everybody hates you. You must know from school," right? Which is a brilliant and devastating heckle.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now, I've noticed when I've seen people occasionally talk about the worst heckles, they say, "This is a heckle that was said to David Baddiel." And it often makes me think, oh, people must think I was that bloke at school.
No.
But I wasn't really, but nor was I. I was sort of an in-betweener. Nor was I incredibly popular. I just, hung around with my friends. But after the 6S Review,
you were Peter Cook and Dudley Moore rolled into one.
I was Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, yeah. And that made me want to be a comedian then.
Did it immediately? I mean, you just thought, Christ, I could do this for a living.
Yeah, I don't know about a living. I just thought that
I could do a lot more.
It's really a good feeling, is what I thought.
But never, because Matt Lucas was here a couple of weeks ago and he
went to my school, of course.
Yes, but he didn't go to. He started university and dropped out, I think, because the comedy stuff started happening for him. Did you would not have contemplated not going to Cambridge?
Well, I went to Cambridge because I knew about Footlights and I knew about Peter Kirk.
Really, that much?
Oh, totally, yeah.
Gosh.
No, I was going to go to Sussex or Stirling for some reason because I was very interested in literature, and the thing I would have done had I not been a comedian is be an academic in literature. That's the other thing.
You'd started your PhD.
Well, later on.
At UCL. Obviously,
I did a PhD. I've actually finished it. 3 years at UCL. Yeah, well, I didn't. At the last minute, I thought, actually, you know what? I seem to be doing all right as a comedian.
Well, let's say we fast forwarded. That's my fault.
Yeah.
So you got there, much more interested in the. But no, you must have still enjoyed the academic side of it.
No, I did. No, I did. Well, it was.
You had the best of both.
But it was a slightly weird 80s thing as well, which is, I wasn't sure about going to Cambridge. I was very left wing at the time.
Right.
And I thought, is it a bit, wrong to go to Cambridge for whatever reason? I should go to Sussex, which was kind of a very right on place, or Stirling. They had a brilliant English course. But then at the last minute, Footlights. And at that point, I had been to the Comedy Store and I'd seen the start of alternative comedy, but I still didn't really understand, that's a way of being a comedian.
Yes.
So I was aware of Python, obviously, and Peter Cook was a massive hero. And so I went to Cambridge, yeah, to be in Footlights.
And what sort of people had you seen at the comedy store? Who were the early? Tony Allen.
Okay. Tony Allen. Yes, yeah, yeah. And I remember a comedian who I had a discussion with just recently on Twitter called Ian McPherson, who the previous discussion I had with him, we'd had a fight. And we made it up on Twitter the other day. But anyway, he's an Irish poet comedian.
Yeah.
I can't remember anyone else.
So you knew that things were changing. And yeah, so you weren't going to go to Footlights and start doing Oscar Wilde sketches.
Well, actually, I mean, this is a whole other thing. But when I was in Footlights, I was doing stand-up.
Yeah.
I mean, I wrote sketches as well, but I was doing stand-up because I'd seen enough to know this is what I want to do, not the sort of character monologue, blah, blah, blah.
Got you.
And then when I came out of Footlights, it was a weird thing because, and this still happens a lot as well, there was a period of about 4 years when being in Footlights was about the worst thing you could have done.
Because of the rise of the edgy lefty.
Because of the rise of, you know, when you see...
They took the piss out of this in the Young Ones,
yes,
didn't they?
When you see that Young Ones sketch where it says something like, Wanker's College
with Stephen Fry and Emma Thompson, something like that.
Something like that, yeah. Tosser's College, Oxford. Yes. And it's all very well for Stephen and Hugh, who, by the way, had made it by then and could very happily be in a self-ironizer sketch like that.
Right,
but if you'd come out Footlights in 1986, which I did, and you rang up the comedy store saying, I'd like to do a gig, please, and they would say, okay, have you had any experience in comedy? And I would say very proudly, yes, I was vice president of the Cambridge Footlights. They'd put the phone down.
They'd put the phone down.
And I'd have to ring them back and say, no, I haven't had any. I'm a different bloke.
So violent reverse snobbery.
Yeah, it was a really violent reverse snobbery, which, by the way, completely, I often get accused of like being part of the Oxbridge Mafia, who just got, it was like of no use whatsoever.
Because it was quite a small window, wasn't it?
Then it changed again.
Because you've got Mitchell and Webb you just were right in the middle of the worst period ever to be
worst period
a Footlights
ever. And
luminary.
Actually, I am one of very few people who got any success in comedy from that particular period.
I didn't know
there's
that.
There's one or two others.
Makes perfect
like
sense.
Nick Hancock.
Yes.
Punt and Dennis, but around about the same period, but really very few. And then it changes, and you get Mitchell and Webb, who, by the way, are brilliant.
Of course, I should stress.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If. Only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us. Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Absolutely. I don't think they're where they are just because of that.
Clear, it's clear where you're coming from.
Yeah,
you just got washed up on a beach.
I just started again, really, and I went and did the London Cabaret Circuit for 5 years.
So you weren't your Spurs. Were you not? So Punt and Dennis, you mentioned, you weren't collaborating with them at this stage.
No. Punt and Dennis were people I knew,
right?
But we were put together, actually. Me and Rob Newman and them were put together by Radio 1.
And for the Mary Whitehouse experience.
Yes. Yeah.
And did you know Rob before that?
I met Rob at Cambridge. Rob doesn't sometimes tell people that he went to Cambridge, but he did. But he wasn't in Footlights.
Okay.
He was this... One of the things about Cambridge, I can't speak for Oxford, I've never been there, sure, is you don't just get, as I say, posh people there.
No.
You also get strange, interesting, unusual
Absolutely.
People like Rob Newman. So
yes.
Rob Newman had come from just a sort of underprivileged background somewhere near Stevenage he's from. He'd had a very rough childhood, Rob Newman, and not got anything like the qualifications he needed to get into Cambridge, but was clearly very bright and interesting and talented, and had ended up in an interview and a place called Selwyn College, and the person there had just thought, this is an interesting and talented bloke, and given him a place. Now, I think that's good.
Yes, I do.
You know, but I don't know if it happens anymore or whatever, but he was like a maverick, and I met him there. To be honest, I don't quite know what happened to Rob's Cambridge career after that. I met him in my first year. Then I'd heard he'd gone to live in Toxteth, which he had. I don't know why. It's not very near Cambridge.
It's quite a commute.
Yes, quite a commute. And I think, I don't know if he dropped out or what, But then I kept on bumping into him in London
on the circuit. Right. So he was doing stand-up as well.
He was doing impressions at the time.
Okay, yes, of course, because he did Spitting actually, Image, didn't he?
And, yeah, but yeah. What I remember most clearly about Rob very early on was I think me and him had just started writing for Week Ending, which was this show on Radio 4 that you could just rock up and
send in jokes.
More importantly, you could go to the meetings.
Oh, okay.
They had an open-door policy on anyone can come to these meetings. There was the commission writers' meeting and the non-commission writers' meeting. And the non-commission writers' meeting was full of nutters. But also it was where if you could write comedy, you got, you know...
Would you take something like that in your stride, or would you be throwing up beforehand in the loo? Or
non-commission writers' meeting?
Yeah, just because...
Oh, no, I'd be all right with that.
Would you?
I was very nervous before I started doing stand-up properly.
On stage,
yeah.
So the audience could be intimidating, but not the sort of rarefied corridors of the BBC with this wonderful heritage of...
No, well, to be honest, it didn't feel very rarefied.
Did it not?
The writers, the non-commissioned writers meeting
still,
was mainly tramps.
Right.
So
just getting a warm.
Yeah, yeah. I think quite a few of them were just tramps. But one thing I remember about Rob is that I've seen him a bit, and I was a little bit wary of him because he had this maverick, slightly mad time in Cambridge. I'd actually done a film, a short film, terrible short film, with him in it,
yeah.
And then he'd vanished. So I thought, like, I'm a bit worried about him.
Yeah.
Is he all right? But then he had some funny ideas, and we ended up writing together. And then he hadn't really started doing the cabaret circuit, but he did an impression for me of Jonathan Ross. And I remember at the time thinking, bloody hell, Jonathan Ross has only just got on the telly. This is a brilliant impression. And the idea then, it might seem odd now, the idea then that you could be an impressionist and not do Frank Spencer and Harold Wilson or
Margaret
whoever.
Thatcher.
Like, yeah, the Bank of Mike Yarwood impressions that everyone who could do impressions seemed to do.
Yes.
That you could do modern people like Jonathan.
Yes.
That just struck me as like amazing. And I know it doesn't sound it now, but honestly,
it does. No, it does.
No one was doing impressions like that. It was there's another guy, Phil Cornwall, started doing that as well. But only him and Rob were doing these kind of like, these are new people with voices we haven't heard, you know, impressioned and exaggerated before. So he'd start doing that.
And were you simpatico? Did you strike up a special friendship because you're writing together? Or
I don't know if we did strike up a friendship. I mean, me and Rob, you know.
But you weren't a double act, in any, except as a writing team.
Well, strangely, I don't know if I've ever been in a double act as such. I've worked very closely and been on stage with and on camera with two other brilliant comedians. Yes. But we've never been a double act like Reeves and Mortimer.
No, I know. I know.
A double act, I don't think. I think, and particularly with Rob, we were writing together and we created the Mary White's Experience with Bunt and Dennis together and characters within that. But we were also doing separate stand-up and, you know, where we used...
Always having your own avenues. How ambitious were you at this point? I mean, 5 years on the circuit means you're doing it at least in large part for love.
Yeah.
But did you have your eye on glittering
prizes?
That's
not true, actually,
James. Is it not?
I mean, I was doing it... Well, love is an odd word because the circuit was rough.
Yeah, but you loved doing it.
Well, I didn't always love doing it. No, sometimes it was fucking horrible. But within a year, I was comparing the Comedy Store.
Oh, okay. So
and I still remember, and I still think of it as one of my proudest moments.
Yes.
And I've had a lot of stuff, but sure. I remember Kim Kinney, who used to run the Comedy Store, coming into the dressing room and saying to me, I think we'll move you up to Compare next week, just in a very throwaway way, deliberately sort of like,
sure.
And I was so happy about that because it was really an honour, and it was difficult but brilliant if you got it right, because the audience were really on the side of the compare, and you got paid £400 for the night even then.
Yes,
you know, so that
proper
was suddenly
money.
Like, because I needed money because I didn't have any money at all.
Sure.
I was on the dole, apart from when I was earning the you know,
yes,
of some course. Of the time.
They're not going to come for you now.
I didn't have any money, and I was just living at home with my parents, who really wanted me to go. It's not like now where you sort of want your kids to, they just wanted me out of there. So that was when I could start to have a job.
Who did you ring? Who did you go to first with that news when you got that amazing news? Who in your life at that time would have been the first person you called?
Well, it was probably my girlfriend at the time. Janine.
What this?
Janine Kaufman, who was my girlfriend at the time. She, probably her, or my brother. I lived with Ivor, my brother, for quite a long time in a flat in Kilburn. And because Kilburn, this goes out all over the world, I imagine.
Yes.
But Kilburn, I used to live. And one thing about doing the Comedy Store in the 80s, when you lived in Kilburn, is that I came back on the night bus quite a lot.
Yeah.
And I remember the first night that I'd done two late nights at the store. So I was coming back like 2 o'clock in the morning or something on the night bus. And looking outside, I thought, oh, there's a riot going on. This will be on the news tomorrow because there's like burning bins and people chucking each other into shops and stuff like that. And then I realised, no, that's what happens every Saturday night in Kilburn. It's just going to be like this. And I think it still is. I think it's resisted gentrification.
Queen's Park stops and Kilburn begins.
Yeah.
It's very, not a line that you cross without your wits about.
Yeah, but probably my brother or my girlfriend at the time.
So, and then
not my parents, strangely.
No, that's why I asked.
No, one thing about my parents is... Again, it's a very key part of the show, but my parents were very 70s parents in that, well, lots of ways, the sex, all that, but in a very specific way, which is, have you got kids?
Yes, two girls.
Okay, so I think the key element of our generation is we stop our lives, I mean, not completely, but we stop them where we need to stop them for our children. Yes. My parents did not stop their lives for us.
Right.
They carried on doing their mad shit. In the case of my mum having an affair, in the case of my dad just swearing a lot and generally not noticing that we were there, and just carried on being totally themselves. They did not think, oh, actually, I've had kids now. That sort of means I've got to change who I am.
It's an amazing shift in the space of two generations.
It's a massive shift, I think. I mean, for me, the only thing that has changed who I am properly is having children.
Sure.
Because I am absurdly, kind of wearingly myself in all situations. And I think, like, fame and all that stuff, it's all been great,
you
know, but hasn't really changed who I am. Having children has changed who I am in a good way. Made me more empathetic.
Yeah.
Made me less thinking about myself all the time. Maybe actually, as it were, physically or metaphysically, whatever the word is, see the world from someone else's point of view. Think about them first instead of having like a reflex thing like, oh, fuck, how does this affect me? I do think, well, how does this affect them? You know,
and
be really like, but I don't know if my parents had that. And one of the things about my parents is my mum really liked the fact, I think, when I got famous, that I was famous and was always first there and it was a premiere or anything like that. But not in her whole life did my mum say to me, oh, I like that joke. That's an interesting joke. Oh, yeah, but nothing, never. My dad a bit more, because my dad was a really funny bloke, but he, at some level, wasn't bothered either. So the idea of calling them
wouldn't have happened.
No.
They're sort of desperate to prove that it was working or seeking approval.
When did
you think you were famous? When would you first have... Probably about 6 months after it was true, you'd have first felt even vaguely comfortable describing yourself.
Well, in Fame Not the Musical, which was the first show, I spent a lot of time talking about the awkwardness of talking about being famous, particularly at a time when I was less famous than I used to be. That's what I talked about in that show. I said, I'm going to talk about being famous, that's going to be complicated, and then I'm going to do something even more complicated, which I'm going to be talking about less famous than I used to be. And I was saying the famous don't really like to talk about being famous, but they really don't like talking about being less famous than they used to be. So I wanted to talk about both those things, because I'm interested in talking about stuff you're not meant to talk about.
I saw you on Jonathan Ross a few years ago when you were clearly struggling a bit with the sense of not being on top of the game as you had been previously.
I don't know, I was struggling with it. I was. I know the show you mean. He ended up...
You seemed quite sad that night, I thought.
No, not really. Do you mean the one where I take over the show because he goes for a piss?
Yeah, I think it was that one. But you kept referring to,
to
having peaked.
Yeah, but that isn't sadness. That's me needing to say that.
Got you.
Because of my sense of, like, Jonathan had me on at a time when I wasn't doing anything.
That's right.
I was sort of like, I think I was starting to think about doing stand-up again and I was writing, but he just said, oh, I think probably someone had dropped out. Mm. Like, do you want to do the show? I said, yeah, all right. And I made a point of saying, you know, normally people come on to say, I'm doing this amazing TV show. You've got me on when I'm not doing anything.
Yes.
And then I think it's a need that I have always to confess, and I will always confess something negative, because I think that that's sort of an exorcism of the negative thing, and then
might
be funny. Sometimes it works.
Because you usually
didn't work completely for that for you, because you thought it was slightly sad.
But just yeah, I did. I thought.
Whereas
I
wouldn't have thought it was sad. I would have thought it was honest.
Yes, we could be both. But I suppose there's something sad about losing status.
Maybe
it was me. Maybe I was projecting onto you and I felt sorry for you, whereas in fact you weren't struggling with the loss of status at all. But this is also the pornography thing you used to talk about pornography.
Yeah, well, I talk about anything.
That's confessional as well.
Yeah, well, I talk about anything that I think is happening to me and that I think people don't... To be honest with you, I don't think I think, oh, what is it that people are not talking about in a kind of, controversialist...
Sure.
Way. I'm not trying to do that. I think that I genuinely try and talk about the stuff that I think I want to talk about.
Yes.
One of those would have been probably at a time pornography. Now I don't feel the need to talk about it as much, not because I don't use it anymore, but because it feels like something that's been talked out.
Yeah, fair enough.
To some extent. Although,
but again, it was a taboo. That's
actually,
why
well,
I
let me tell
it.
You something that hasn't been talked about pornography, which if I do ever talk about it again, this is what I will say. Because actually I got asked by someone at Channel 4 to do a thing about pornography, about internet pornography, about how I feel now, having talked about it a lot when I was younger, having a kid, you know, blah, blah, like a boy who might be looking at it, whatever.
Yeah.
And I sort of said, oh, I wouldn't be interested very much in the sort of like, oh, I've changed my mind about it, whatever, even if I have a bit, because this is actually what I think. What I think is that internet pornography, no doubt, is harmful in a thousand ways. No doubt it is. But it's done one good thing, which is really good, which is when I was growing up, pornography was essentially heterosexual pornography, just one image of a woman. And it was sort of a 22-year-old, probably blonde, sort of woman with enhanced breasts or not, whatever, incredibly thin, etc. That was really all you saw in VHS pornography or magazine pornography. Now, if you find erotic an 87-year-old, you know, mixed race amputee who's 27 stone, she's out there, and not only is she out there, there's a whole fucking site devoted to her and all her mates who look the same. And no doubt, feminists, and I consider myself one in, you know, in my own way, but no doubt if it will say, oh, well, that's just her being degraded. I'm not sure about that. What I think internet pornography has done is democratize the erotic and smash apart, to some extent, that incredibly oppressive, homogenous idea of what an erotic woman is, and say, no, really, very, very unlike that, women are going to be found erotic by lots of people, and no doubt men as well. And I think that's a good thing. There's lots of shit stuff, I'm sure, it's done as well, but I think that's a good thing.
Have you listened to John Ronson's new podcast on this? The Butterfly Effect? You'd enjoy that, I think.
Okay.
So it's a big recommendation.
Okay. I've always thought that the use of women and the use of women's bodies in mainstream stuff, so in newspapers, obviously page three, but also I did recently got into a thing you might have seen on Twitter where I attacked the Times for posting, you know, I posted this thing where they'd used two women in bikinis to say that the Ashes had started.
That was it, yes.
And my point was not you shouldn't have women in bikinis in the newspaper or that I don't like looking at women in bikinis in some kind of puritanical way. My point was this is what's bad.
Yes.
What's bad is this is treating women as objects.
Yes.
In my opinion, much more than pornography.
Which has an honesty to it.
I think it does have an honesty to it. And as I say, trust me, you will not see in the Times or indeed on the side of a bus an 85 stone, you know, mixed race amputee. You won't. You will see it in pornography.
Yes, it's true. And that I kind of need to steer you back slightly.
Sorry, you're probably right.
And, no, not at all. Because
for
I don't want to
spend safety.
I don't want to spend a lot of time looking at the Mary Whitehouse experience and then you and Rob Newman going off to do your own thing together. I mean, the first Rock and Roll Comedians was the thing. You played Wembley Arena. You were huge. What was that like? I mean, were you just caught up in it in such a way that you didn't have to? Because you like to analyze stuff. I just wondered whether this, because it didn't end happily with you and Rob Newman, was this the period of your life where you didn't analyze stuff? You were just on a sort of on rails.
No, I did analyze it.
Were you constantly?
Yeah, I wasn't happy for some of that, and I was really happy for other bits of it. What? The first bit of it, I mean, in terms of your question before, I would say it was me and Rob had done the first series of Mary White's Experience on the telly, and we were doing a live gig at the venue. Now, as I said, I've been on the cabaret circuit for, like, I don't know, 5 years, so I was used to just rocking up at a comedy gig, and no one really knows who you are, and you have to win the audience round, and who knows how many people are going to be there. There were queues around the block at this place called The Venue in South London. It was a 900-seat venue. They couldn't get everyone in, and I'd never experienced that. I'd never experienced, and it hadn't really occurred to me that being on telly might do that. Obviously, it might, but it really hadn't occurred to me that suddenly live gigs might be something that people will come to and be fans, like really fans. And that was what happened, and that was when I realised, oh, fame has a tangible thing as a comedian, which is you can go on stage and people will like you already.
Yes.
And actually, that might lead to complacency, but also, as a comedian, I think that was really helpful for me because I've been used to this slightly aggressive, tight 20 that I did, you know, in comedy venues where I thought, all right, I'm going to come out fighting and show you blokes, mainly blokes actually at the time, but, you know, that I'm, like, able to be funny.
Yes.
Whereas now I could relax and, like, oh, if I can try out some stuff, and actually they won't boo me off if one joke doesn't work.
Because they're there because they already like you. Huge difference.
It's a huge difference for a comedian.
Yes,
I don't know about anyone else, how they're famous, how it affects them, but it's a tangible thing for a comedian, is you think like, okay, I no longer have to be someone who proves that he's funny. They sort of think I am already. And it makes for a more relaxed stage live thing. And that was great, and I really liked that. And I really liked... You know, I thought we did some great work in the Mary White's Experience or whatever. And then, yeah, then mine and Rob's relationship went toxic, and that became really hideous for a while.
So you were still performing together, but you couldn't stand the sight of each other?
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, actually, couldn't stand the sight of each other seems like a weird thing, weird way of putting it, because I don't think I ever felt that about Rob. Rob may have felt it about me.
Right.
I don't think I can't stand the sight of him.
Why would he have felt it about you?
Well, what happened was that Rob became... You know, and it's two sides of this story, I'm sure. But Rob became, from my point of view, unbelievably paranoid about sort of top billing, as it were, about sort of like, I think Rob felt, because he was by far the most beautiful one, and we had quite a lot of sort of female fans and all that stuff, that people might think, and I think Rob was, at the time, was quite an insecure bloke, because I'm the beautiful one. I mean, again, this doesn't, like, it's not that good for me anyway, this, but because I'm the beautiful one, people will think Dave is the clever one and the sort of creative powerhouse. He's got glasses. He's Jewish.
Right.
People will think that. And that wasn't true. You know, basically, as far as I'm concerned, if you're in a creative partnership with someone, especially a comedy one, you're both doing what you're doing. And it's a chemical thing that you've got together, and no one is really, especially when you're writing together, no one is really, you know, more responsible, less responsible. You have to accept that. But Rob became convinced that some people might not think that, so we had to change our name from Badil and Newman to Newman and Badil.
Right.
And then he became very obsessed with all that, and very obsessed with, like, you know...
So his insecurities hurt you more than they hurt him in a way.
Well, I didn't really mind it all at first, when it was stuff
but
like...
It gets draining.
You know, but after a while it became draining, and then it became like... My mistake was, Rob decided as part of that he wanted to be interviewed by himself. And so I said, well, all right then. And then... journalist would interview me, and I do have a problem with discretion, and sort of I tend to just say what's on my mind. So they would say, oh, how's it going? And I would say, oh, I think he's gone mad.
Right.
He seems to have gone a bit mental.
Yes.
And that would then be in the paper. Then he would get really angry, and then he would come and shout at me.
Yeah.
And one time I remember him shouting at me, and then another time him slagging me off on stage and blah, blah, blah. And after a while, I thought, I'm not enjoying this anymore.
Can't do this anymore.
I'm not enjoying it.
But you had so much involvement, I mean, because you must have been making oodles of cash at the time, so it's hard to walk away from, or not?
I mean, we were doing well, and I don't know if I thought about the cash. I think I thought about what a shame it is that this really powerful creative partnership that is doing incredibly well on TV and live or whatever is going to come apart. But Rob as well, I'm sure, wasn't happy.
Couldn't hold it together.
But I absolutely couldn't be in it any longer, because it became about that primarily.
Was it with you when you woke up in the morning? Were you waking up and thinking,
Well, let me tell you a very short story. I know you want to get on to other stuff. But this is how bad it got. We ended up, we'd had one of these bust ups and we weren't speaking. And then we were doing Leicester de Montfort Hall, which is a 3,000 seater venue.
Big space, yeah.
Yeah. And Rob, I didn't watch his set by now. He didn't watch my set. And at the time, we were doing stand up and sketches, which we always did. It was always not a complete double act, as I say.
Yes, yes.
So I did a new bit of material in my set. I went on first. And it was about the fact that the IRA at the time were not allowed to speak directly on the TV. They had to have their voices malformed in some weird way. It was a weird Thatcher thing. Do you remember it?
Yeah, of course.
So, and lots of comedians had done jokes about it, but I did some joke about it. The joke I cannot remember in and of itself. But clearly, Rob had put a new bit of material in his set later in the second half about that. And I didn't know that, but meanwhile, he's off stage. He's standing there in his Jarvis outfit. Now, Jarvis was a character that was like a sort of lounge lizard, sort of posh man who just talked about sex. Very funny character. He's standing there in that. He's about to come on as Jarvis and do a Jarvis bit. But as I go off, we haven't spoken for 3 days. He goes, you cunt, you fucking cunt. You knew I did a bit of material about that, you fucking cunt, right? And then goes on. And then I go into his dressing room at halftime and call him a cunt for about 20 minutes. There's about 7 journalists on this tour all writing feature pieces about the new rock and roll. I mean, it's falling apart. is what I'm saying. And so I think we collectively decided we'll do Wembley, which was planned already, and right. that's it.
And that was
and lots of people said, oh, it's a publicity stunt. And it
but it really wasn't.
It really wasn't, no.
As history has attested.
Yeah. I bumped into him recently, and we were photographed recently.
Yeah,
it was
that.
Really nice to see him.
Had you missed him, or would that be the wrong word?
Well, when I saw him, I thought, you know, he's a really funny bloke.
Yes.
I think he's unbelievable. When I worked with him, he was an unbelievable talent. Like, really incredibly wildly funny and interesting and unusual. And
very mercurial, as well.
Yeah, but he's brilliant stand-up and also fucking hilarious writer. All that. And when I saw him again, I just thought, oh, we actually really got on.
Oh, that's
you
nice.
Know, and it was really yes. nice to see him again. But there had been some talk about, I can reveal this now, when we were pictured together, it was at the HarperCollins, because we both write right. books now, yes. HarperCollins. So it was a picture of us looking really old, and I wrote, comedy is the old prog rock. Because we looked like two old members of Genesis or something. And then Wembley got in touch. Wembley Arena got in touch Straight with up. My agents yeah. and said, 25 years, do you want to do a reunion gig? And I thought, well, I don't know what we'd do, really. Right. But I thought, I'll ask Rob, and Rob yeah. just said no.
Still.
I'd ask Robert, do we want to chat about it? Robert yeah. said, no.
Not interested. Yeah. Door closed.
Yeah.
But then again, if he'd said yes, you might have
panicked.
Cacked it. Yeah.
yeah. I mean, well, I would have thought, if he'd said yes, I thought, I had no idea what we're going to do.
No, of course. You know,
I mean, we can do history today and not even have to make up for it.
You could do it straight. Yeah. And then what happened? Was it, because what was the gap between that and when you started working with Frank Skinner?
About
was that,
2 weeks.
Was it really? You went straight yeah. off to...
Yeah, because what happened was I'd become friendly with Frank. And actually he was probably telling Frank about all this sort of very depressing stuff that's going on between me and Rob.
Yes.
And
Frank Skinner has dark places in him as well. I mean, it's
He certainly does.
Yes.
But they're different dark
yes.
places.
Yes.
And they're not about that quite. There's not certainly not those kind of insecurities.
No.
But what happened with Frank was on the cabaret circuit, I had bumped into him a couple of times. And we'd bonded about football. I know that sounds cliched, but it was exactly what happened.
Yeah.
We were watching, I think it was Egypt, Republic of Ireland in the 1990 World Cup, backstage at Jonglers, you know that club?
Mm-hmm.
I was still on the cabaret circuit in 1990. And we started arguing, right? And I said, I can't bear the way they play. And he disagreed with me. But at the end of it, I thought, oh, he's quite a good bloke and he really knows about football. And apparently he thought the same thing. And then Frank split up from his girlfriend. He'd originally already split up from his wife
yeah.
due to a very complicated Catholic issue.
Right.
He was very worried about all that to do with, I could tell you, explain the whole thing, but it would take another
sure,
podcast.
Don't worry. Yeah.
And he was in a bit of a state and he didn't have anywhere to live. And I hardly met this bloke, but I said, oh, well, I've got a flat in Kilburn. My brother would move out. It's a box room in it. You can go and stay there for a couple of weeks. He stayed with me for 6 years. I never put the fucking rent up. He became, over that time, a regular on British television.
Yes.
I never put the rent up, 40 quid a week, which I'm not even sure he paid, to be honest. But we became very close. And then I stopped working with Rob. And just as it happened, I've been doing, I think it was on Radio 5, they'd had a regular fantasy football, not a show like
no.
our show, but just a league.
Yes.
And I was a member of the league. And as a result, the bloke who brought fantasy football to this country, he called me up and he said, do you think this could work on the telly? And I said, I don't know, maybe. And I spoke to Frank about it. And then we just created the show. And
that was huge immediately. There was no slow burn with that, was it?
No, it was very big. I mean, in yes. a very cult way, in
sure.
a very post-pub 90s way. But yes. Yeah, I mean, and now would be huge because it like got 3.5 million
yeah.
that sort of Friday night at 11 o'clock.
It would be.
Yeah.
And that for someone of my age, that was, I mean, you were the two coolest dudes on telly at that point.
That's good. Yeah, well, it was a brilliant show to do.
And it ran for a while brilliant. And you got to do the song and you know, with Lightning Seeds. And
yeah.
I mean, you were sort of king of football.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the song is a whole other thing. You know, people ask me sometimes about, you know, my proudest moment or whatever, which I don't know if it's the proudest moment or whatever, but I do think that the moment that Three Lions was first sung at Wembley when
yeah.
I was there, which was a spontaneous happening, because in that tournament, England hadn't done very well, had drawn with Switzerland, and then played Scotland, and the first
yeah.
half wasn't
yeah.
very good.
Yeah.
And then in the second half, basically, Gary McAllister missed a penalty. Then Gazza scored, then the sun came out, and then a man who I will always be grateful for, but I don't even know the name of, the DJ at Wembley, against the FA's instructions, because they'd said, don't put that song on.
It wasn't officially endorsed.
Not officially, yeah. official, it's not, it's a bit partisan.
Yes.
Put it on anyway, and the whole crowd joined in. like without any sense that I had that they knew the words or anything.
Oh,
you know,
man.
You know, and it was literally the most extreme moment.
Was Frank there?
Yeah, Frank was next to me.
Yeah.
And then girlfriends as well. And Frank's girlfriend at the time was half German, I remember. But anyway, that's sort of irrelevant. But the sense of hitting the spot, I suppose, with something that you'd done, it's very rarely encapsulated in such a moment. You know, you do something and you hope it's going to work. You hope people are going to like it. And sometimes they do.
Yes.
And then you realise that gradually, a bit like I was talking about with noticing that me and Rob had sold out this place. Like, oh, I see, we're doing all right.
Yeah.
But with that, it was like,
wow,
this explosion of people saying, this is our thing. You know, and also, we were really happy anyway because England had just won and they were playing well. So the euphoria of that is hard to imagine. You know, it's really hard to imagine. I remember the Holland game, which, as you remember, we won 4-1 and the people were singing the song by then, like mental.
Of course. Yeah.
My manager saying to me, this is incredible. He said to me, if you win an Oscar, it won't be better than this. Now, I very much doubt I'm going to win an Oscar, but I sort of knew what he meant, which is, it must be brilliant to win an Oscar, but at the end of the day, it's an industry thing. Mm. Whereas this really felt as close as you could get to the people.
Yeah, and the zeitgeist. You. It must have been phenomenal.
We wrote those lyrics.
Yeah.
We wrote those lyrics.
And they are brilliant lyrics.
I think they are brilliant
lyrics. They really are.
I think they are because they're vulnerable.
Yes,
I think
exactly.
That's the key element.
And they capture the element. And it couldn't have been written by two people who weren't proper football fans. You couldn't have cobbled that together because you got a marketing success in another area and they said, can you do as a football song? That was proper fans. And that's why... Yeah. It cut through so much.
Ian Brodie, the music's brilliant, I think. It's a beautiful song, but also Ian Brodie had noticed that. Ian Brodie decided that he wasn't, I mean, he's a football fan, but he didn't feel quite equipped to write the lyrics. He was a big fantasy football fan, so he phoned me and Frank up and said,
from his canal boat, if memory serves.
And said, can you write the lyrics? And we slightly cheekily said, can we sing it as well? And he went, well, all right then. So it's sort of amazing, really. But that thing of it being us knowing what it means to be an England football fan, let's try and capture how that really feels. I don't think that would be done before with a football song. Even like the New Order one, which a lot of people like, which I think is a good song, it's not really a football song.
No, and it's much more studio-y.
It's a great song, but it's a love song, really, with a John Barnes rap in it, whereas our song is about football. It's got Gary Lineker's name in it, Bobby Charlton's.
Yeah.
And it did capture something, and it also did something else, which I think maybe has gone away now because of one of your favourite subjects, which is Brexit and stuff, which is, I think we managed, if you go and watch the footage of that, you see loads and loads and loads and loads of people waving crosses of St George. Yeah. And we managed for a brief moment to create a type of English nationalism which didn't feel aggressive, triumphalist, racist. It felt vulnerable.
Mm.
It felt like, actually, you know, this is a great country, but maybe there's a way of singing about it and being it, which is not really aggressive and horrible.
Yes.
And for a moment, that was there, and now it's gone again.
Seems to have done. We're pretty much out of time, so we need to talk a little about the tour that you're going on with the show. We've talked a lot about the show and the astonishingly intimate details that you share. I have a much better understanding of who you are now after spending this time together and why this actually isn't a remarkable departure for you. Or it isn't in any way a kind of change of direction. It is just you looking at the things you find most fascinating about yourself and your world and trying to make sense of them through performing. So it was the loss of your dad, clearly, that focused...
No, my dad is still alive.
Sorry, the loss of your mum, forgive me, that focused your mind on their relationship and your family. Who was the first person that you told you might do a stage show about your mum's 20-year affair and your dad's dementia?
My brother.
And how did he react?
not well at all. My younger brother, I was at the time, when I first decided I was definitely going to do it, I think I told my older brother in London, but I then went off and I did a discovery show in China. I did this thing about the Silk Road. And so I'd written to my brother because he lives in New York. He's a cab driver in New York. And I'd written to him and said, look, I might be doing this. And he just wrote a one-line thing saying, back, you're not doing it. You're not doing it. And I just thought, oh, Christ, what's difficult about this is I know that it's going to be a celebration.
Yes.
I know it's going to be come from love, and people aren't going to feel this is a trashing of either of my parents.
And you know that absolutely, but you can't necessarily articulate it until it's happened.
It's hard to explain it until you see the show.
Of course.
You know, and so I had to say to both my brothers, I know neither of you want me to do this, but you're going to have to trust me. And now both of them do really like it. And I suppose the key moment was, my younger brother hadn't seen it at this point, but I did it at the Chocolate Factory first before I did it in the West End. And my older brother, I'd said to him, I'm very, very close to my older brother, come and see the workshops. I did workshops at Soho Theatre. And if you don't like anything, you really don't like anything, I'll take it out. I don't know if that was true, but I said it anyway. And he sort of avoided it. I think it was so pretty soon after my mum died, only a few months, and I think he found the idea difficult.
You were grieving. This is how you processed
it. Definitely, this is how I was dealing with my own grief. Yeah. She died very suddenly. So partly it was like trying to deal with this sudden absence, and she didn't have that long coming to terms with it thing. So then he comes on the first opening night at the Chocolate Factory, and there are loads of critics in the audience, quite a small theatre. I'm looking around, I can see Michael Billington from The Guardian and blah, blah. And I had a Q&A encore at that point, which I've now stopped for various reasons, just because I got the same questions every night and I got bored of it, so I've changed it. But then I had a Q&A, and there's all these important critics. I can see loads of them. Bloody Quentin Letts is there, for goodness sake. Really? All sorts of people. And in a very me way, I said, look, I'm sorry if I alienate anyone with this, but I have to find out, first of all, what my older brother thought of this show. He didn't have his hand up. I was a bit worried. And I said, Ivor, what did you think? And he said, oh, I loved it. And then he said, I loved it because it felt like she was in the room.
Oh.
And it did make me cry on stage, but it made me realise something very important, which is the whole fucking show is saying, let's try and describe people who have gone, whether they've gone through death or gone through illness, it's as they actually are. If you do it as they actually are, if you hold to the truth, then even if those truths are negative, it's a celebration of who they are. Because people will come away thinking, oh, I really know who that person was. And that's what felt to me good about it. People have come up to me after the show and said, oh, I wish I'd met your mum. And what they mean is, I feel like I know who she was properly. So that thing that I started with was saying, when you say she's wonderful, you're basically erasing her out of existence. Yes. Let's try and be absolutely true about her and see where that gets us. I had achieved that.
That was brilliant. Thank you, David.
Thank you very much.
And that was David Baddiel. I'm joined now by Rich, who produces the Unfiltered series. We can call it a series now, can't we?
Yeah.
It's got quite a body of work together.
In double digits now.
And I hesitate because I think we may have knocked at this door in the past. I'm still waiting for one to go horribly wrong because I think that went really well again, didn't it?
God, someone's going to catch on to us soon.
It is. So we've sort of come a cropper. But it's a lovely mixture of, I mean, he's clearly big on analysing himself and thinking about himself, but not in any way that makes him seem like someone who has an over-inflated opinion of himself. I don't know quite how he does that, actually, to find himself so fascinating, but not in a way that makes you think he doesn't find other people fascinating.
Yeah, I think it's because he seems like someone that's analysed himself so much. He's gone round the block. He's gone beyond. He's gone through sort of the less agreeable part of that, and he's back around to the other side now.
Yes, and you can't really ask for more as an interviewer, that someone who really nothing's off limits, and
absolutely not.
If anything, he suffers from an inability to self-edit.
Yeah, like I was sat in the control room, and you know, you were talking about anti-Semitism, I think, and then someone phoned me, and I left the room, and I came back in 2 seconds later. And you were talking about dementia, and then something else happened. You were talking about something else, so I was like, oh my god, like,
of all of the ones we've done. That was probably the one where I panicked the most with 10 minutes left, because I glanced down at the clock and thought, oh my lord, we've still got so much ground
to cover.
Yes. And we've had bits like that with Robert Webb and Matt Lucas and perhaps the professional performers. But with him, it really was a sense that, probably because I know his work so much and it goes right back to my school days, that I reckon we could have done 3 or 4 hour long separate podcast looking at separate areas of his life. I'll suggest it to
him. We'll do a 10-part series.
I'll suggest it to him when I go backstage at his gig next year.
Ooh la la.
You're listening to Unfiltered with James O'Brien, brought to you by Joe.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.